Welcome to the Fabric Podcast and our exploration of purposes and preferences. In a live gathering of Fabric in Minneapolis, Greg Meyer poked at some common preferences to make things tidy, not only with how we lean towards certainty, but also the temptation of homogeneity or the sometimes very subtle ways of creating a culture of conformity.
There was an election on Tuesday. Did anybody notice? Yeah, like how could you miss it, right? The midterms. There were winners and losers, like there always are. And I don't know how your preferences fared on Tuesday, how happy or disappointed you might be, but the election had a lot more going on, it seemed, this year and other years than simply choosing between candidates. It felt kind of like a battle. It felt like a civil war over who's going to have control over our country. Now, I have election results that I prefer. And those preferences, I don't think are very superficial. They're grounded in some really deep purposes that I hold and that I've considered. They're beyond me. They're beyond the moment. They're beyond, I think, superficial causes. But, you know, they're mine, and they're my evaluation of that and so on. I do the best I can with that. Probably you have the same thing. But there's another level of purpose, another level of preference, too, for me that transcends the result of the vote. And chances are, it's not just me, you probably have the same sense as well. And that is, that has to do not so much with the result, like I said, but about the nature or the context of the election. And that's really kind of what was getting at me. Yeah, you can be doing that and seeing where you sit on all those questions. And, you know, it has to do with the ability for us to be the United States, right? Not 50 states, not 3,143 counties or 332 million individuals, each of us, you know, chasing after our own preferences, but together. I mean, elections are meant to be that, and they can be that, I really think. I think they're the conversation that allows the desires of the many to coalesce around something, and then we are the best one we can be with that. That's a hope, right? That's the possibility there. But it probably isn't so much what's been happening in recent years. I think we've fallen off that quite a bit, at least not often enough. Elections have become that line that's drawn in the sand. There's not just winners and losers, there's good and bad, maybe even evil, right? The other side. And we question not only their judgment, we question their morality, we question their deserving to have a voice. And when we speak that way, we have to remember that we are talking about other people. We're talking about each other. We're talking about other human beings, our neighbors, our fellow citizens, people with whom we're going to need to work together in order to make this thing work, right? So I have voted in 23 biennial elections now, you know, in my life, and I have sensed disappointment. I've sensed frustration every time, but I would say the animosity, the anger, the ill will has been growing in recent years, and I think it's kind of reflected up there. I've been worried about that, and I bet you are too. This was the headline on election morning for the Star Tribune. Threats, fear, suspicion build to election day. It's like I saw that, and I just folded the newspaper back up and set it down. It says, I can't go there. It's just like too close to home for me. So, you know, we'll see what's happening in the next couple of months, but I have a sense that the results weren't so much in one side's favor or another, but they, to me, they spoke that maybe we've all have had enough of that, and we want to find something. We want to start pulling back together. I sort of sense that. We don't know, right? It's a work in progress. So I'm not here to talk about the election, even though I did for the last 5 minutes, right? But it is a great, and it's a very dangerous example of the power of preferences run rampant, devoid of the purposes that are meant to ground and to guide them. I think it really has been. And what's causing it is nothing new. It's all about our human instinct to divide when being together is hard. And folks, we need a purpose to guide this preference inside of us to divide when being together is hard. We need a purpose to guide that. Now remember, we've said this, I think, every week. human beings will do almost anything to avoid pain. Now, physical pain is almost nothing compared to the ongoing pain of having to accommodate or having to set aside all of your wants, all your preferences, all of your perspective on life in order to accommodate, to make room for, to allow someone else's wants and needs and perspectives and lifestyle. I mean, that is what really wears us down. And dividing because of fear and separating, you know, and separating in order to avoid conflict, this is as old as humanity. In fact, it is so deep-seated in us that the book, this ancient book that aims to help us understand our humanity, even starts with God having to learn that lesson. Now, I find that fascinating, all right? You know the story, even if you don't know the Bible. It's the story of Noah and the ark, right? You can find the first book of the Bible, Genesis. It's roughly chapters 6 through 9, if you want to go back and read that. And in this story, people, humanity, were going the wrong way from where God intended them to be, right? So God had had enough. And God decides that God's got to do something about this, right? So God circles up the people that are still on God's side, that's, you know, Team Noah, and then decides that everybody else should just be gotten rid of. That was the flood. Wipe out, wash out, clean slate, get rid of the troublesome others. Sure, in that story, they're depicted as wicked or bad, so possible justification, yeah, you know. But nonetheless, you know, be gotten rid of. And the fact that they are depicted in that story as wicked, doesn't that sound familiar? I mean, isn't that what we do? I mean, the people that are on the other side, the people aren't living out life the way we believe it should be. We demonize them. We stereotype them. We label them. We distance them. We make them others, right? And by the way, did you ever kind of figure that this is a legendary story from like the origins of the world, that it's maybe not so much a story about what God was learning, but maybe if God had to learn that lesson, maybe we're supposed to learn the lesson? Anyway, I think that's what's going on here. Don't miss that. All right. Anyway, afterward, when all said and done, what did God do? Did God say, well, that worked. Now I found a great way to make sure everybody is on my side. I just get rid of the people who aren't, okay? Did God do that, or did God say, I will never do that again? God said, I will never do it again. And the story has, this is the origin story of rainbows, right? Try to explain why we have rainbows in our world, right? They didn't quite understand physics and stuff like that, so they had a story like this to tell. And so God puts a rainbow in the sky and says, when you see that rainbow, that's going to be a reminder to me, God says, be a reminder to me of the covenant that I'm going to make with you, telling you and reminding me to never do that again, all right? So God says, I will never decide to unite us, right, by getting rid of the people who are not united with me, right, which isn't really uniting, is it? God chose to be bigger than that. And the rainbow was that reminder, that mindfulness bell of the possibility, the value, the goodness in all people, no matter what. And guess what? That's a sign for us too. Have you ever seen a rainbow? Yeah, you know, you have, right? That beautiful, miraculous light after the rain, there to remind us that there are better ways of dealing with people that we don't like, that we don't agree with, that we don't understand, that we don't appreciate. You ever think of that story that way before? That this is really a story for us, and us get over that idea of how to deal with the others in our world? Okay, so let me get back on track here and bring this around. We're talking about purposes and preferences. And we will like to keep the world tidy. Like to keep our world tidy. Now, that doesn't mean not leaving dirty dishes in the sink. It doesn't mean making sure you dust every week. What it means, that tidiness that we want is trying to keep all those annoying, disagreeable, different people from inflicting their differentness on my world. That's the tidiness that's really at work inside of us. And your preference, mine too, our preference for keeping our world's tidy from the impact of other people is impacting the way that we connect with them. Now, when someone makes my world messier, I'm not real happy about that. Right? Less tidy. I would rather not connect with those people. I mean, I'd rather just leave them out. I'd like to ignore them, forget them, push them away off to the side, whatever. After all, I mean, it's a big world. There are a lot of people. I mean, who will miss them, right? I mean, I can easily live my life and not have to rub shoulders with them in any meaningful way where it really bothers me or whatever, okay? You know, besides, you can't be best buds with everybody, so what's the problem? You know, we'll just sort of ignore each other. Yeah, that worked really well, right? So indigenous people get put on reservations where they're kept out of the comfort zones of the white folks that are moving into the country, or even among white folks. You have Norwegian, you've got German, you have Polish, you have Lithuanians, you have Irish and Italian neighborhoods, and then we stratify them economically as well, and then we have slavery and apartheid and segregation and Jim Crow and redlining in order to keep, you know, people of different racial backgrounds from interfering with the comfort zones of white people. We have all kinds of ways of doing that stuff with each other, and it becomes quite a mess. So dividing is a great and a relatively easy way of dealing with other people, right? People who are different from you. And like all these issues that we've talked about as we were exploring purposes and preferences, I get it. I mean, I know I do it. The world is a big place. There is so much going on, and it comes at us so fast, and I have to assert some control. I've got to somehow, you know, tidy it up a little bit so that I can survive, so that I can keep on going. I get that. But the question is dealing with those people the way to handle my overload with the world? I mean, really, am I dealing with other people, or am I in relationship with other people? Those are very different ways of being connected to other people, either to deal with them or to be in relationship with them. In Genesis, that story about Noah, it's really clear that God chose being in relationship instead of dealing with. All right? God's saying, it's a better idea. Maybe harder up front, but it's going to work in the end. The thing is, division is easier than forging connection when the going gets tough. Yeah, it is. But you can't keep dividing forever, can you, right? David Attenborough, love this guy. He taught me this when talking about the environment, but I've lived by this, and I can't help but remembering it. He said, if you can't keep doing something forever, it is, by definition, unsustainable, right? I mean, can you argue with a statement like that? Dividing over and over again into smaller and smaller subdivisions because of our preference to be with people who are just like us gradually turns us into a planet of individuals, because I'm the only one who actually agrees with me on everything, and sometimes I kind of worry about me, you know? We do that until we're a world, a planet of individuals all looking after themselves. And that, to me, sounds like a description of the apocalypse, not a description of the promised land. We can't keep heading there. So connect or disconnect? When the going gets tough, are you going to connect or are you going to disconnect? It's amazing what you can learn from your kids. When Chris and I were raising our kids, we didn't use the timeout strategy that much. It always felt a little bit harsh. But my daughter, Natalie, uses it all the time. Okay? So her 3.5-year-old son, Gavin, yeah, he was the guy in the video closing the doors a couple weeks ago. You might remember that. Okay? So when he gets to that really frustrated point where it's just, you know, the wheels are falling off and everything is going south, she says to him, it's time for a break. And he knows exactly what that means. And he puts down whatever he's doing. I've watched him do this a dozen times. He puts down whatever he's doing, and he goes and climbs on her lap, and they breathe together. Now, wow. Go to your room for 15 minutes before you come back out. That's a timeout. Go sit in that chair over there until you tell you, you know, and think about what you just did to your sister, right? You know, how well does that work? You can't really enforce it very well. It feels cruel, it's fought against, and you kind of have a sense that you're resented, not appreciated for what you just did, and in fact probably built more of a wall than a bridge right there at that moment. No, instead, Gavin actually asks for a timeout when he starts having those feelings, because he's being connected, not separated. And together, they find a new oneness that comes from the inside rather than being reinforced or being enforced from the outside. I don't know how she got so smart. I didn't teach her that. But anyway, division is such a convenient way of dealing with the untidiness of differences. And there are other so-called convenient ways that we have of dealing with them, and they work about as well. You know these as well as I do. We could probably come up with quite a list, but for example, if you can't isolate from those people who are different from you or isolate them from you, maybe you can convert them. Maybe you can convince them, right? Make them see it your way. You know how we do this, right? You talk louder, or you bully, or you just keep those merciless questioning going on. How could you possibly think that was right? How could you possibly think that was a good thing to do? How could you possibly, you know, live like that? We do that kind of stuff. What we really want to do is we want to take that screwdriver and, you know, get it in their brains and make a couple adjustments until they finally see it our way, you know, the right way, right? And it almost hardly ever works. Right? It doesn't work. It doesn't work. It tends to build bigger walls rather than the bridge that you imagine, that bridge from the other side where they are across to, you know, the right, the better, the comfortable side where you are, right? It just doesn't happen. So, a quick recap. Those strange, different, and hard to understand people, they make your world uncomfortable and messy, and you and me and people in general, we prefer to keep it tidy, right? And we got two main ways of doing that. We give up on unity and we head towards division, and we try to drum the differentness out of other people so that they're going to be more like us. If it only worked, right? You know, if it only worked. We've seen it tried. Alas, they don't. They create tribes. They create resentment. They do not create unity. So, 16 years ago, we started Fabric. I'd seen these things at work. We'd all seen these things at work in groups of people. And we knew that this preference for people to continually divide in order to preserve unity through similarity, that would be a constant tendency that we would need to check. I mean, pretty much any organization, but look at churches. Why do you think there are hundreds of brands of Christian churches out there? Because they all have a common vision, or because some of them are right and, well, each one is right and everyone else is wrong, right? And it's not just Christianity, Islam, Hinduism. I mean, even Mormons have been doing the same thing. I mean, it's a people. It's not the religions, it's the people, right? We also knew that the way that we would tend to keep that comfortable similarity is by enforcing conformity, right? How can we enforce conformity? Conformity about what everyone in our church believes, or conformity in our traditions, our practices, conformity maybe around race, around culture, around you know, economic status, all those sorts of things. We didn't want that to happen. You see, we want unity, but we also don't want division. And we value diversity and not conformity. So one of our core values, and this was established before we ever had one gathering, was this: we seek unity in diversity rather than in conformity. We seek unity in diversity, not in conformity. And that has been guiding us as we try to lead this crazy bunch of people, this community, since day one. Preferences, these ungrounded preferences at least, they tend to sort you out from the people who aren't like you. Purposes, those deep, enduring calls that come from within you that are tied to this, you know, fabric that we are all part of, they tend to unite you with people who aren't like you. We need to be driven by purposes first. Now, unfortunately, the church has been all about conformity and therefore division. and not unity and diversity. And that's despite what its founder was trying to show, right? So Jesus, he kept pulling people in without any conformity strings attached. Did you ever notice that? I mean, read the stories with that lens sometime. One that comes to mind to me in particular is from Matthew, the story about Jesus' life that I've been actually using every week through Preferences and Purposes. This story about Jesus, you can find it. It's in the 8th chapter of Matthew's gospel there. I think it starts at verse 5. But Jesus is there, and this Roman centurion comes up to Jesus, all right? So this is a Roman, and he's a soldier, right? Not a Jew, not like Jesus. I mean, very different. In fact, the Roman centurions, Romans in general, despise the Jews. So not a good relationship. But nonetheless, he comes to Jesus because he once asked Jesus to heal his servant. And Jesus, he's ready to do it. He says, yeah, no reservations. I'll come to your house and I'll heal him. Doesn't make any distinctions. Doesn't make him be, you know, one of them first, okay? But then he's really surprised by what this centurion tells him. He says, no, you know, you don't have to do that. You don't have to come to my house. He says, I understand authority. I tell my soldiers to go do this and they do it. I tell soldiers to do that and they do that. You have the power to heal my servant right here and right now. And that just stopped Jesus in his tracks. He says, let me read this. Never have I seen such faith. Never in all of Israel, in among his people, the people that are supposed to get it, the insiders for Jesus, right? Never among all of my insiders have I seen such faith. I understand, and then he goes on and he doesn't say, well, this is what he doesn't say, okay? He doesn't say, well, if you get circumcised, and if you learn the Torah, and you stop eating pork, and you renounce the Caesar and pray to Yahweh alone, and a couple of other things like, you know, go to synagogue on the Sabbath and wear a yarmulke, then I'd be happy to help you out. No, he recognizes the unity that they have within, despite all the differences in the outside, and that's all that matters for Jesus. This is Jesus' pattern. He meets a Samaritan woman at a well, John chapter 4. Now, Samaritan, right? That's code. Samaritan is a sect of Judaism. They hate each other. They worship in a different place. They have different understandings of the Torah, everything like that. So they're always at each other's throat. And Jesus changes her life forever by accepting her for exactly who she is, not by fixing her so that she will be someone or something else. And then there's Jesus' parable of the good Samaritan, right? He makes the same move there in that. Who is the hero of that parable? It's the Samaritan, right? Though the outsider, the one that the Jewish people would recognize as being wrong and, you know, not doing the right thing, not fitting in, not being the kind of person that they would want to be with. But he is the one who sees across all the divides. He's the one that recognizes the man on the road as another fellow human being and does whatever he has to do. He builds bridges instead of walls, you know? And then, I mean, I could go on with story after story where Jesus exhibits the same sort of expansive welcome, but just think about this motley crew of people that he chose to be his key central followers. We call them the disciples, right? He picks people that have almost nothing in common with each other, you know, not particularly skilled at anything, and except for one thing, except that they're all captured by this vision of their lives and of the world that Jesus imagines for them, and they want to be a part of that. And they want to be a part of it with anybody else who wants to be a part of it. So now in these stories, we not only see this pattern of unity in diversity instead of in conformity, but we see something more. It's something pivotal to how unity is forged in this context, a diversity, which is kind of what the world is like, right? Because face it, making a bunch of things, a bunch of people that are incompatible with each other, work together to be one is pretty hard. So how does it happen? And the way Jesus does it time after time is kind of different from our normal instinct. And I think it's important for us to take a minute to think about this because it's important both for us in this community and for us in our families and our workplaces and our schools and for us in the world, right? And this is what happens. When we disagree with someone, And we don't want that to blow up and make us all go our own ways. We tend to look for common ground, right? What is that smaller and smaller bit behind what we disagree about that we could all sort of agree with, we could find in common? We look for a common denominator, right? Now, don't get me wrong, that's a good thing to do. Find those common denominators. It's a great place to restart a conversation with some understanding rather than mistrust. But it often feels kind of small. It kind of feels generic often and innocuous, and we stall out when we get to that point of actually applying it to the issue that we were divided on in the first place. Now, Jesus takes a different tact at it. He doesn't look back. He doesn't look for a common denominator with the person that feels like they're on the other side, some smaller piece that different people from both sides could settle on or maybe agree with. No, he looks forward to something bigger. He held out a vision worth pursuing in every case. He holds out a vision that's worth pursuing. For that centurion, Jesus didn't look for similarities between, you know, Judaism and, you know, the Roman pantheon, so they could, you know, find a place where they meet and they could build from there to do something. No, he didn't tell parable that described the basic idea behind all these different Jewish sects that they could all agree on. Instead, he painted a picture of a world in which every person saw themselves and everyone else as a neighbor, something that they couldn't resist. He didn't explain how his very disciples could, you know, somehow function as a team because they all brought these different skills, and can't we appreciate this about that person and this about this person? No, he infected them all with a vision. He infected them with all something, with an idea about the world and a way of looking at the world and being included in the world that was big enough for them and something they could imagine themselves being a part of, and then he set them loose to go build it. And they did. Now, I'd call that purpose. He didn't show them why this would match their preferences. No, he handed them a higher, a bigger way of being that was more filled with meaning and fulfillment, a purpose. Now, Jesus called that way of finding our unity and purpose the kingdom of heaven. That was his language for it. He called that the kingdom of heaven. Or sometimes he called it the kingdom of God. Actually, those are used interchangeably. Now, when you hear the kingdom of heaven, the kingdom of God, that is not referring to where someone goes when they die, right? That isn't at all where this is going. For Jesus, the kingdom of heaven was, to use our fabric language, right, is anywhere and everywhere people align with how the fabric of the universe is truly woven. That's where it is. That's how it happens. Or to put it in Bible speak, into the language that Jesus would use, the kingdom of heaven appears when we live according to the will of God. Do you see how those are really saying the same thing, right, with different language? That is not a bad vision. I mean, the kingdom of heaven, when we are all aligning with the way the world is really works, what really matters, and that long haul, that long term, that other-centered vision, that's pretty good stuff. Jesus could see it. He could see it. It seemed like he lived there. And rather than using that perspective where he was seated and seeing the world as a kingdom of heaven and using that to judge all the people who didn't, no, he used it as a way to open it up to them, to welcome them in, to let them be a part of it and to find their own places there. He wasn't offering a doctrine to believe in. He was giving them a vision to be inspired by, something they could gather around, see themselves part of, along with all those others who were invited to the party. Now, when we make this move, to understanding what this is all about, not that backward one of finding something smaller, you know, some little incremental thing that we still agree on, but instead we move forward to something that is beyond us, our vision gets bigger. It gets bigger, it gets wider, it gets more open. And our actions get personal. They get individualized. They have focus on where, the when, the who that we happen to be on. We do both of those at the same time. Our hearts and imagination grow bigger than our individual differences or similarities, and it gets more personal too. And we see people, we see individual people. We long to know them, to learn from them, to learn with them. Now, when I'm pulled towards this kind of unity with them, you know, those other people, the them that otherwise probably means the people that's too hard to include in my world, those people become real people. They become people with real hopes, real dreams, real fears, real ideas, real potential, real strengths, and real flaws. Real people. To use Valerie Kaur's language, the stranger becomes my sister, my brother, my mother, my uncle that I have not met yet. Whole different sense of curiosity there. And no, when we do that, it doesn't always work, does it? I mean, you've tried it, and it doesn't work sometimes. It didn't work. How well did it work for Jesus? I mean, but we know where he ended up, but what happened to the impact of his life and of that dream that he shared? Did it end with him? Did his ever-expansive welcome not continue to shape the world, even to today, where we still carry it out and try to make it real? Now, for Fabric, this unity and diversity, not conformity, is an issue. Diversity, yeah. Look around here. Pretty white group of people. Pretty homogenous. A lot of things that maybe we have in common. Maybe we're a little bit too comfortable overall. Too much like each other. That's something we ought to take a look at. Are there ways that we consciously or unconsciously make an understanding that there's a requirement for conformity in order to belong here? Now, we should not be afraid to ask that question, because while it may be at work among us, it doesn't need to be, because I truly believe that that isn't what is making us Fabric. It's just a layer that it gets added on because we are these things called people, and that is going to happen, and we need to continue to remind ourselves to open it up and to, you know, make sure that door isn't closed. We aren't here. I don't believe any of us are here to feel comfortable sociologically. I think we are here to feel safely uncomfortable as a human beings that we actually are. I think that's why we show up. We know that there is stuff to learn, there's stuff to grow. We know that this world is a lot bigger, and it is a wonderful place when we do it together. That is why we are here. I mean, look at the diversity that is here. We are Christian. We are not Christian. We are Christian adjacent. We are Christian curious. We are Catholic, Lutheran, Methodist. We are recovering Catholic, Lutheran, Methodist. We are agnostic, we are atheist, we are humanitarian, or just plain skeptical. I don't know, how would you describe yourself? I don't have a label for myself, and I don't want one, because none of those labels describe why I feel I belong here. I think it's a completely different issue. So what unites us? If we aren't all the same brand of something, what makes us Fabric? What makes you Fabric? Most churches, they have a tab on their website. If you go to the tab, go to the website of virtually any church, there's going to be a tab that says what we believe. I just randomly went to four, and sure enough, everyone has a what we believe part of the website. That is supposedly defines unity to which they all conform. Now, we don't have one of those tabs on our website, and I get reminded about that often, and I love having those conversations. Now, there's a lot to say about that, but in short, there's not some, you know, core theological tenet that we all agree on that unites us. So what does unite us? So if we don't have on our website something that says what we believe, what would that tab say? The thing that points at our unity, that you'd read about it or find out about it, what would it be called? So, you know, a couple of my thoughts, the things that I came up with might be questions we explore or hopes we share. Convictions that we find compelling. Or maybe something like, why we belong together. I just think there are healthier approaches to all this. So I kind of sense we're on the same page. There are many experiences of this and many ways of saying what it is that makes us a community of varied, not the same people. And what's so fascinating is that we're coming at it from so many directions and we're all headed towards some vision of being a community that makes us willing to put up with each other and maybe even value each other. I mean, that's kind of crazy. It's not something smaller that we all have the same. It's something bigger that we're all headed for. Now, here is an audacious claim. I wouldn't have started this community if there wasn't an audacious claim to be about, right? And it's this. You know, all this angst over what's happening to our social fabric right now, the stuff that our divisive political and social world is all consumed with and maybe being eaten up with and all those things are dredging up, I believe fabric is an antidote to it. In fact, this is my audacious claim. Fabric is an antidote to the divisiveness that our society is experiencing. Now, that doesn't mean that the whole world ought to be here. It doesn't mean that everyone needs to do everything that we're doing. What it means is that we are part of a grand and a growing experiment that can open our hearts. It can open our hearts wide enough to be part of a movement of weaving the fabric rather than unraveling it. All right? I think it means that we are part of this grand experiment. And this grand experiment is bigger than we are, and it will go on with or without us, but it needs us. It needs me. It needs you to be a part of it. And it's something that we can do. You know, why are we able to be that antidote? Why are you able to be that antidote? Let me tell you why, because I think you have all you need. First, you know a vision to pursue. And I believe it's in the heart of each and every one of us already. And we keep walking toward that horizon where we are living out that kingdom of heaven that not only has room for everyone, but it values them as well. And we know to walk there with curiosity. We know to walk there with imagination. We know to walk there with empathy for those whom we would rather not bother with, those people that we do not see as deserving or worthy of our consideration. There they are. There. Right. We have that, all right? So we know that vision. And we know that the walk there is long and we'll make mistakes along the way. The other thing that we have is we've got a place to learn and to practice. And that's here. And I don't mean field school. I don't mean Sunday mornings. I mean fabric. We have a community to do this with, and particularly in groups, so that you not only have ideas and inspirations, but you have people, companions for this journey who will help you to integrate that dream into your life, and they're going to support you. They're even going to lend that friendly mutual accountability that we all need. We need it from each other. We need to provide it for each other, because that's how we learn together, and that's how we make progress on things together. So, anyway, so when I first started working on this this message a month or so ago, I wrote down my ideal outcome. Like, if I could somehow speak this to you guys and it just worked and you totally got it, this is what you would walk away thinking, or this is what I would walk away thinking, right? So I'm just going to throw out my hoped for outcome, all right? After hearing this, I suddenly have an urge, not a revulsion, but an urge to know why someone I don't agree with, the way they feel, the way they think, the way they act, I don't have revulsion to do that. In fact, I am surprised to detect a tender spot in my heart for them, and I want to know them better. And then I also have this strong sense that the people who see this community differently from me, they aren't dragging me down or watering down the fabric that I want. No, they are offering something that we need. They're filling out the circle. And we really, really need more people doing that. Grandiose, but it's a vision for us, and I'm going to hang on to that one.
Thanks for listening. We hope this podcast sparks conversation in other parts of your life. If you're looking for meaningful connections, there's a fabric group for you to try, whether you're in the Twin Cities or not. Tag @FabricMPLS with your wanderings on social media and find resources on our website, fabricmpls.com.